Greetings, everyone. My name is Gardi Mathalier. I am a fourth-year medical student applying into anesthesiology in this upcoming match. Today, in this podcast, we're breaking down everything you've ever wondered about anesthesia. What it is, how it works, and what actually happens when you quote-unquote go under. Most people don't really think about anesthesia until they have a procedure or surgery they have to undergo. And even then, it can feel like a pretty big mystery. Questions like, what does it actually mean to be put to sleep? How do doctors know how much anesthesia to use and give you? And what's happening in the OR when I'm asleep? So in this episode, we're going to start with the basics. We're going to talk about the different types of anesthesia, how they work, and why they're used. Then we'll talk about the science behind it. What's actually happening in your body, in your brain. We'll also talk about what patients go through before and after anesthesia, and what's happening behind the scenes in the OR that you'll never get to see. And of course, to wrap things up, we've got an anesthesiologist answering some of the most common questions about anesthesia. So if you've ever been curious about the field, if you're just trying to understand what happens before your next surgery, this is the place for you. So let's start with a simple question. What is anesthesia? Most people think of anesthesia as just going to sleep before surgery. But I think that's really far from the truth. Anesthesia is a very controlled, reversible state. And that can include unconsciousness, pain relief, amnesia, muscle relaxation, and autonomic stability, all of which are tailored to each patient specifically for their procedure. But to put it simply and in layman terms, anesthesia allows us to turn off pain and sensation in a controlled manner, making surgery possible without distress or discomfort. But before we get into the science, let's try to break this down into a real-life perspective. Imagine you're living in the 1800s. You have a leg infection, and you need an amputation. What exactly are your options? Maybe you get a shot of whiskey to dull the pain, or a really strong man could hold you down while the surgeon saws through your leg. Maybe you're lucky and there's some opium or ether. But that's it. No pain control, no muscle relaxation, no anesthesia team monitoring your vital signs. And that sounds pretty brutal. This is why anesthesia is one of the biggest breakthroughs in medicine, because without it, modern surgery would cease to exist. Now let's talk a little bit of stats. There are 300 million surgical procedures performed all over the world every year, and almost all of them require some form of anesthesia. Before anesthesia, surgical mortality could be as high as 50%, and that in part had to do with unbearable pain and shock from the patients. Today, anesthesia-related deaths in healthy patients are less than 1 in 200,000. That's safer than driving a car, folks. So the four types of anesthesia, what are they? There's no one-size-fits-all when we're talking about anesthesia. The type that we're going to use is going to depend on the procedure we're performing, the patient, and the risks at hand. So let's go through the four main types. First, we have general anesthesia, which is what most people think about when we say anesthesia. It's considered the full blackout. It's often used for major surgeries like heart surgery, brain surgery, and abdominal surgery. It's achieved through IV medications like propofol and ketamine, and inhaled gases like sevoflurane and desflurane. This kind of anesthesia requires airway management, which is often done via intubation or with an LMA or laryngeal mask airway. Next, we have regional anesthesia, which is used to numb a region of the body. This can include epidurals, which are often used in labor and childbirth, and spinal anesthesia, which is used for C-sections and some orthopedic procedures. Regional anesthesia blocks nerve signals at the level of the spinal cord, so the patient is awake but cannot feel the area. Third, we have local anesthesia. This is a small area of numbness. This is used for very minor procedures like skin biopsies, in the dental office for dental fillings, or even when patients need stitches. Often involves injections of lidocaine, bupivacaine that are injected directly into the surgical area. Last but not least, we have sedation, often termed as MAC, or monitored anesthesia care, where the patient is sedated, relaxed, but responsive. This is what we use for colonoscopies, endoscopies, and other minor forms of surgery. It's a continuum from mild sedation to deep sedation, so the patients can be fully conscious or nearly unconscious, but still breathing on their own. So let's shift gears and talk a little bit about the history of anesthesia. How did we get here? Let's take a trip back to the first ever painless surgery recorded. In this case study, we will explore the first public demonstration of ether anesthesia. On October 16, 1846, William T.G. Morton, a Boston dentist and physician, performed a public demonstration of ether anesthesia at Massachusetts General Hospital. His patient, Edward Gilbert Abbott, underwent a tumor remover surgery on his neck. In the audience were surgeons and medical students who watched in shock as Abbott felt no pain and remained motionless. This event is now known as Ether Day and changed medicine forever. Before anesthesia, and as we mentioned earlier, surgery was a little barbaric because there was no way to control pain. This meant that surgeons had to work as fast as possible, making limb amputations as quickly as possible and often aimed for under 60 seconds. Most patients either died from shock or refused surgery altogether, even when necessary. After anesthesia, surgeons gained time. Surgeons could now operate more carefully and precisely, and this caused surgical mortality rates to decrease significantly. These advancements in anesthetic drugs made surgery safer and more effective. Now, we've come a long way from ether and chloroform. Today, anesthesia is a true science. Some interesting facts from anesthesia is that induction and general anesthesia usually takes less than 30 seconds when using drugs like propofol. Patients can wake up within minutes after stopping anesthesia, and this is due to rapid metabolism and clearance. In modern anesthesia machines, we can continuously monitor breathing, heart rate, and brain activity to ensure safety and prevent complications. But even with these advancements, many patients still have a great fear of anesthesia. So let's talk about some of the most common concerns. One thing that I've come across quite frequently are patients afraid of waking up during the surgery. This in all is extremely unlikely and occurs in less than 0.1% of cases. There are many safety features like BIS monitoring, for example, that ensure patients stay asleep. On the other hand, some patients ponder, what if I never wake up? Anesthesia is reversible. The drugs that are used are cleared by the liver, the lungs, and the kidneys. in healthy patients, the risk of not waking up is very minimal and almost zero. One common myth is thinking that anesthesia is like normal sleep. This isn't true at all. General anesthesia is closer to a medically induced reversible coma, where consciousness is completely suspended. So let's imagine a little bit. Let's say you're Michael, 28-year-old male, going in for ACL reconstruction surgery. During your pre-op time, the anesthesiologist would explain the risks and confirm your medical history. Next comes induction. Once in the OR, you'll be given IV propofol, and under 30 seconds, you're unconscious. During the surgery, anesthesiologists perform maintenance with the use of a ventilator, which will assist your breathing, and gases like sevoflurane to keep you asleep. As the surgery wraps up, you'll go through something called emergence. This is when the drugs are stopped and you wake up in the recovery room feeling groggy but pain-free. And for millions of people like Michael, anesthesia makes painless, safe surgery possible every day. So far, we've covered the different types of anesthesia, the history of anesthesia and how it revolutionized medicine, common concerns and myths when it comes to anesthesia, a real-life patient experience with anesthesia. Now let's take a deeper dive into the science. In segment 2, we'll break down how anesthetic drugs actually work inside of the body, from the brain to the nervous system to recovery. Now that we've covered the history and the different types of anesthesia, let's dive into how it actually works. What happens when you're under anesthesia? How do these drugs affect the brain, nerves, your entire body? In this segment, we'll break down the mechanism of anesthesia, how the different drugs work at the molecular level, the three phases of general anesthesia, induction, maintenance, and emergence, how anesthesiologists monitor anesthesia depth to ensure safety. So let's get started. To understand how anesthesia works, we have to start at the neurochemical level, specifically how anesthesia affects the CNS, or the central nervous system. There's two things to consider when we talk about how anesthesia affects the nervous system. First, it enhances inhibitory pathways, which slows down brain activity. And second, it blocks excitatory pathways, which prevent the brain from transmitting pain and sensory information. Let's look at how different anesthetics achieve these effects. In general anesthesia, most general anesthetics work by enhancing GABA, the brain's primary inhibitory neurotransmitter. GABA, short for gamma-aminobutyric acid, is like the brain's off switch. It dampens the activity in the neurons. Drugs like propofol, sevoflurane, and barbiturates bind to GABA-A receptors, increasing their effect and causing sedation, unconsciousness, and amnesia. This is why patients lose awareness within seconds of receiving IV anesthetics. But general anesthesia isn't only about turning off consciousness. It's also about preventing movement and preventing pain. Pain signals travel from the surgical procedural site through the spinal cord to the brain, and anesthesia can block these signals in many ways. First, there are opioids, which block pain receptors at the level of the spinal cord. Things like NMDA antagonists, like ketamine, block glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter, preventing pain processing in the brain. Others like local anesthetics, lidocaine and bupivacaine, directly block sodium channels, preventing the nerves from firing. Regional and local anesthesia both stop the pain at the source. Instead of affecting the entire brain, regional and local anesthesia work by blocking nerve conduction. Epidurals and spinal anesthesia, for example, block nerve transmission in the spinal cord, preventing pain signals from reaching the brain. Peripheral nerve blocks, injected near major nerves, work to numb specific region of the body. In short, we can think of general anesthesia as turning the brain off, whereas regional and local anesthesia work to block pain at the source without affecting consciousness. Now that we know how anesthesia works, let's talk about the three distinct phases. First up, we have induction. This is the lights out phase. In induction, the patient is given an IV anesthetic like propofol, and within 15 to 30 seconds, they lose consciousness. Paralytics like rocuronium and succinylcholine may be used next to temporarily relax muscles so that an endotracheal tube can be placed. At this point, the patient is completely unaware, immobile, and is pain-free. Next, we have maintenance. This is about keeping the patient under. During surgery, anesthesia is continuously administered via gases, sevoflurane or desflurane, or IV infusions. The anesthesiologist will monitor your vital signs like your heart rate, blood pressure, and oxygen levels to make sure that you're at the correct depth of anesthesia. Adjustments in anesthesia are made in real time. Too little anesthesia, patient becomes too aware and might start moving. Too much anesthesia and vital functions could become suppressed. Third, we have emergence, which means waking up safely. Once the surgery is over, anesthetic drugs are discontinued. The patient's breathing, heart rate, and reflexes start returning back to baseline. Inhaled anesthetics are exhaled through the lungs, while IV anesthetics are metabolized by the liver and the kidneys. The endotracheal tube is removed once the patient can breathe again on their own. Most people wake up within minutes, but full recovery from anesthesia can take hours to days, and this largely depends on the drugs used and the patient's condition. Let's talk a little bit about how anesthesiologists monitor anesthesia depth. One of the most important jobs of an anesthesiologist is ensuring that the patient is at the right level of anesthesia. Not too deep, not too light. This is done by using several key monitoring tools. One that I've seen quite often is called a BIS. It's a bispectral index monitoring, and it used brain waves to measure activity to assess the depth of unconsciousness. Next, we have end-tidal CO2 monitoring. This ensures proper ventilation and proper gas exchange. Third, train of four monitoring. This kind of monitoring checks for muscle relaxation levels when paralytics are used. It ensures that the patient remains immobile. Last, we have MAC, or minimum alveolar concentration. This is different for all of the inhaled anesthetics, but essentially determines the potency of those inhaled anesthetics. If anesthesia is too light, patients might experience awareness during surgery, although this is rare. If the anesthesia is too deep, it can cause low blood pressure, slowed heart rate, and delayed emergence. This is a constant balancing act, which is what makes anesthesia a highly specialized and skill-intensive field. Let's talk about another real-world example of how anesthesia is applied. This case will explore a 62-year-old man undergoing open-heart surgery. The patient has a past medical history of hypertension or high blood pressure and diabetes or high blood sugar, requiring careful anesthetic management. During induction, IV propofol and fentanyl are used to sedate and block pain. During the maintenance phase, a combination of inhaled sevoflurane and IV infusions help keep the patient stable. For monitoring, we are using end-tidal CO2, BIS monitoring, which help ensures that the patient remains deeply anesthetized, but not overly suppressed. During this patient's emergence, once the surgery is complete, anesthetic agents are stopped, and the patient gradually wakes up. This case highlights how modern anesthesia is fine-tuned to each patient to maximize both safety and comfort. So we've arrived at our second checkpoint. So far, we've covered how anesthesia works at the molecular level, three phases of general anesthesia, how anesthesiologists monitor depth to ensure patient safety, and a case study of anesthesia in action. In segment three, we'll talk about what patients experience before anesthesia, from preoperative evaluations to fasting guidelines and managing anxiety. Now that we've covered the science behind anesthesia, let's shift our focus to what patients actually experience before undergoing anesthesia. Anesthesia isn't just about the moment you lose consciousness. There is a whole process leading up to it that's just as important, if not more important. Before any anesthetics are given, there is a detailed preoperative evaluation that has to occur to make sure the patients are safe. In this segment, we'll cover preoperative assessment, why it's so detailed, and what information anesthesiologists gather, fasting guidelines, and why they matter. It's not necessarily about just avoiding food. How anesthesiologists assess risks and plan for complications. Most common patient concerns, and how anesthesia providers work to manage their anxiety, and a case study illustrating the preoperative process in action. The preoperative assessment is the most important step in the anesthesia process. At least that's what I think. Before any surgery, the anesthesia team carefully evaluates patients' medical history, physical status, and any potential risk factors which may cause complications during and after surgery. It isn't just about gathering those informations, but preparing for possible complications before they happen. Here's what happens during this assessment. The anesthesia team will talk about any previous surgeries and anesthesia experiences. Has the patient ever had a bad reaction to anesthesia? Do they have any family history of bad reactions to anesthesia? We'll talk about chronic conditions. Do you have hypertension, asthma, diabetes? We'll cover the medications and supplements you might take at home. Some drugs, like blood thinners, need to be stopped before any surgical procedures. We'll also cover allergies. Allergic reactions to anesthetic drugs are rare, but are life-threatening. Some medical conditions require additional precautions. Patients with heart disease, cardiovascular disease, might need prior preoperative clearance. They may need to get an EKG or a cardiology clearance. Diabetic patients may need blood sugar monitoring and insulin adjustments prior to their surgeries. And patients with asthma might require preoperative bronchodilators to prevent issues during the surgery. Next, we perform an airway assessment. Will we be able to secure an airway once the patient has been sedated? A difficult airway is one of the biggest challenges in anesthesia. Anesthesiologists will check for any neck mobility issues, since limited movement can make intubation more difficult and challenging. Something called a Mallampati score to assess airway difficulty. Patients with obesity and sleep apnea have a greater risk of airway collapse under anesthesia. If deemed to have a difficult airway, anesthesiologists may need to perform a fiber optic intubation or an advanced airway technique to ensure proper oxygenation. All patients undergoing anesthesia will be asked, when was the last time you had something to eat or drink? It's a common frustration for patients being told not to eat or drink hours before surgery, but it's crucial for safety. So why then do we ask patients to not eat or drink prior to surgery? When under anesthesia, the body's normal reflexes become suppressed, including the ability to prevent stomach contents from entering the lungs. If a patient vomits while unconscious, their stomach contents can enter their airway, causing aspiration pneumonia, a serious, potentially fatal complication. Here are the standard fasting guidelines from the ASA, the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Clear liquids, which include water, black coffee, and juice, are allowed up to 2 hours before surgery. Breast milk is allowed 4 hours before surgery. This is for infants. Light meal, things like toast, fruit, yogurt, shouldn't be consumed for at least 6 hours prior to surgery. Heavy meals like meat, fried foods, and any dairy need to be stopped 8 hours before surgery. For these reasons, patients often receive a direction to not eat past midnight the day before their surgeries. This will ensure adequate time prior to the surgery for gastric emptying. There are some exceptions, though. Diabetic patients may be allowed some glucose or sugar drinks to prevent low blood sugar. On the other hand, patients undergoing emergency surgery don't have the forewarning of fasting. And in this case, an RSI, or rapid sequence intubation, will be performed to protect the airway and prevent aspiration. For many patients, fear of anesthesia is worse than the fear of the surgery itself. Common concerns, like we covered earlier, patients might have, what if I don't wake up? What if I wake up during surgery? Other concerns like, I've never had anesthesia before, what does it feel like? Can anesthesia affect my brain permanently? It's the responsibility of the anesthesia team to address these fears and concerns prior to the surgery. This occurs through patient education. We explain that anesthesia is safe, carefully monitored, and highly controlled. Patients who are deemed nervous may be given midazolam, which is a mild anxiolytic prior to the surgery. It's also important to open the floor for any questions the patients might have in ensuring that all concerns get addressed. So how do anesthesiologists go about in predicting and preventing complications? Before any surgery, the anesthesia team determines risk factors using the ASA physical status classification system. It goes from ASA 1 to ASA 6. In ASA 1, the definition is a normal, healthy patient. This includes a non-smoking or patient that engages in no alcohol use or minimal alcohol use. An ASA2 classified patient is a patient with mild systemic disease. These mild diseases exist without substantive functional limitations. These patients can be current smokers, social alcohol drinkers. They can have pregnancy and obesity between BMI of 30 and 40, as well as patients with well-controlled diabetes and hypertension. A patient with ASA3 is a patient with severe systemic disease. These patients often have poorly controlled diabetes or hypertension. They may have COPD and be morbidly obese. Patients with ASA4 are patients with severe systemic disease that is a constant threat to life. An example of patients in this ASA classification may have had a recent heart attack or stroke. ASA5 describes a moribund patient who is not expected to survive without the surgery. These are patients with ruptured abdominal thoracic aneurysms, patients with massive trauma, or patients with intracranial bleeds with mass effect. And finally, we have ASA6 patients. These patients are declared brain dead, and their organs are going to be removed for donor purposes. Let's explore this case study about a 72-year-old man with severe heart disease undergoing surgery. The patient has severe coronary artery disease and chronic kidney disease. The anesthesia team recommends a full cardiac workup to assess his risk. Instead of general anesthesia, a combined spinal epidural technique is chosen to reduce the stress on the heart. Surgery is completed successfully and with minimal hemodynamic instability. This case highlights why preoperative planning is essential. Adjusting the anesthetic approach dramatically improved this patient's safety. So far, we've covered everything leading up to anesthesia. The preoperative assessment, how anesthesiologists evaluate risk, and what the patient experience is like before going into the operating room. But now, let's shift our focus to something patients don't experience, because they're unconscious. While you're asleep under anesthesia, the operating room is a world of constant monitoring, real-time adjustments, and silent communications between the surgical team and the anesthetic team. Anesthesia isn't just about putting you to sleep. It's about keeping you stable, preventing complications, and ensuring a smooth recovery. So in this next segment, we're going to pull back the curtain and explore what patients don't see. Now, let's talk about what happens after the patient is induced and what happens in the OR other than the surgery at hand. There's an entire world of decision-making, problem-solving, and constant adjustments that have to happen behind the scenes. The patient has to be kept alive, stable, throughout the surgery. So in this segment, we'll explore what happens in the OR while the patient is unconscious, how anesthesia is constantly adjusted in real time, and the invisible teamwork that keeps surgeries running smoothly. Often, when people think about surgery, I think they picture the surgeon as the main character. But what's the reality? The anesthesiologist in the room is constantly running calculations, adjusting drug levels, and anticipating complications before they occur. So that means the surgeons and the anesthesia providers are in constant silent communication, even if no words are exchanged between them. For example, if the surgeon suddenly clamps a major blood vessel, the anesthesia team may notice a change in blood pressure seconds before the surgeon might notice the problem. If the patient's muscles are too tight during a delicate surgery, the anesthesia providers might need to adjust the muscle relaxant without the surgeon even noticing. And in the event that blood loss is higher than expected, anesthesiologists work to perform fluid resuscitation and transfusions as needed. The overall idea being that anesthesia is never static. There's a lot of real-time adjustments being made. And unlike the one-time injection, anesthesia is an active, ongoing process that's constantly undergoing fine-tuning. Here's what you can expect the anesthesia providers to be monitoring minute by minute. They're monitoring unconsciousness and making sure that the patient is fully under but not overly sedated. They're monitoring pain control and adjusting opioids or nerve blocks as needed. They're monitoring muscle relaxation. Remember when we talked about the train of fours? Yeah, monitoring muscle relaxation. The patient is moving too much, then we have to give extra muscle relaxation drugs. And this is a highly skilled procedure. Every patient metabolizes anesthesia differently, meaning that the anesthesiologist has to make some real-time calculations based on the patient's weight, their age, their liver and kidney functions, and other surgical factors. Anesthesia providers are also constantly adjusting IV fluids to prevent dehydration and maintain circulation. They administer vasopressors like phenylephrine to stabilize blood pressure if it drops too low, and adjust ventilator settings to ensure that the patient is getting an adequate amount of oxygen. So what if? What if something goes wrong? How do we anticipate emergencies before they happen? The best anesthesia providers don't just react. They do a lot of anticipation. Here are some split-second decisions that might happen behind the scenes. Using a BIS monitor, if patient brain activity suggests that they are too lightly sedated, we can immediately increase the anesthetic depth to prevent awareness. This ensures that the patient fully stays unconscious. Let's explore this next case study of a 58-year-old male undergoing abdominal surgery. He does have risk factors. He has a history of severe acid reflux and high risk for aspiration under anesthesia. So what happened? The anesthesia providers performed a rapid sequence intubation to prevent aspiration. During the surgery, the patient's oxygen levels dropped suddenly. This suggested some kind of airway obstruction. Given their preparation, the anesthesiologist was ready. They quickly adjusted the ventilator settings, gave a bronchodilator, restoring oxygenation before the surgeon even noticed an issue. And it's done so well that the patient would never know that this happened. And without constant vigilance, it would have led to respiratory failure. So now that we've talked about what happens in the OR after the patients are unconscious, we can appreciate how much is actually going on during the surgery to keep patients safe. Anesthesia is more than just going to sleep. It's an incredibly precise science requiring continuous monitoring, fast thinking, and anticipation of all possible complications. So next time you or someone you know undergoes anesthesia, remember, there's an entire team dedicated to your safety, making split-second decisions that you'll never even know about. Every aspect of your care is adjusted and fine-tuned in real time to make sure you get the best possible outcome. And thanks to decades of advancement, anesthesia today is safer, more effective, and more personalized than ever. Now, it's obvious that anesthesia can seem like a bit of a mystery. So to clear up some of the most frequently asked questions, I reached out to an experienced anesthesiologist, my brother, to answer the things that Now, we know anesthesia can be a little bit of a mystery, even after the super informative podcast. So, to clear up some of the most frequently asked questions, I reached out to an experienced anesthesiologist to answer the things people really want to know. In the next segment, we'll dive into the anesthesia Q&A, where we'll cover some of the most common misconceptions, concerns, and surprising facts about anesthesia straight from an expert. Today, here we have with us Dr. Matelier, who also happens to be my older sibling, a board certified anesthesiologist. He's going to go ahead and introduce himself now.
My name is Gerard Olivier Matelier. I typically go by my middle name. I am a Haitian American. I'm currently living in Maryland, an anesthesiologist who went to med school at Howard Un University College of Medicine. Subsequently, went to residency in Miami, Florida, with Jackson Memorial Hospital in the University of Miami Hospital Systems. And currently, I am an attending anesthesiologist at the Johns Hopkins University at the Bayview Center.
Thank you for that. Let's start by talking about induction. Can you walk us through a typical induction sequence for general anesthesia?
For general anesthesia, typically there are differences in the type of induction. The standard one would include after making sure the patient is positioned well to their liking into the comfort level. Second, making sure that your oxygen level is up to par, your vitals are stable. And then the typical induction would, as far as medications are concerned, would include local anesthesia. And that's used for two factors. One, to provide some localization or numbing the vein. That's because the propofol can be painful in injection. So you numb the vein with the local anesthesia, and also the lidocaine on the local anesthesia blunts coughing reflex or the airway reflexes, so that the patient doesn't react significantly when you try to intubate. Then, after the local anesthesia is on board, you give a little bit of fentanyl to reduce the stimulation for pain control. And then you would give your main anesthetic agent, which can be either propofol if the patient doesn't have any huge cardiac issues, or another agent that's used rarely but quite efficient on a cardiac patient, is etomidate. You inject that to provide your anesthetic, and then you would paralyze with either succinylcholine if you would do a rapid sequence induction, or rocuronium if you would do a standard induction and intubation. Rocuronium is a paralytic as well as succinylcholine. Then you would have agents for blood pressure management, phenylephrine, ephedrine, and you would make sure that your fluids would be wide open to prevent any drop in hemodynamics.
That was really insightful. Thank you. The next question I have is, what are the biggest challenges in airway management?
So now that we've induced the patient, we are faced with securing the airway. And when we will be doing that, we're faced with questions. The two main challenges that we're looking for: can we ventilate the patient, and or can we intubate the patient? Typically, for new trainees or medical students, the thrill is to intubate. However, one would argue that ventilation is more important. So you can face with a challenge of not being able to ventilate a patient, but you're able to intubate a patient. Or you can face with a scenario when you can't intubate a patient, but you can ventilate a patient. Now, let's say you induced the patient and you cannot intubate the patient, but you can continuously ventilate, meaning applying the bag, a mask, and bagging the patient, giving them oxygen while you're essentially going to your alternative airway measures to try to intubate the patient. You can induce the anesthesia and you try to ventilate the patient and that's not adequate and go right into intubating a patient. Sometimes you can bypass the ventilation and go straight into intubating a patient. But the biggest challenge is when you push the medication, you induce a patient, especially when it was unexpected, you cannot ventilate and you cannot intubate a patient. Now that becomes an emergency and you would have to activate all your emergency protocols, calling for help, extra hands, having other resources and other technologies to try to secure the airway, and ultimately having the surgical team available to essentially provide a surgical airway. That's a brief summary into ventilation and intubation. However, after intubation, you might be in a situation where you still can't ventilate a patient, and that is also scary. Very soon, or ultimately at some point, other trainees or medical students would learn the stressors when that happens and why that happens.
Okay, nice. So the next question I have is, what happens if a patient has an unexpected reaction to anesthesia?
Unfortunately, in the field of anesthesia, you're always in vigilance mode because the unexpected happens. Even if rare or the common blood pressure issues or heavy stimulation, there are some rare things that can happen that you always have to be ready for or that you may have to keep in the back of your mind. So when those things happen, let's say an anaphylactic reaction, a difficult airway, a positioning issue, a, God forbid, a malignant hyperthermia, which is probably one of the scariest things you can see in as an anesthesiologist. When those things happen, it's essentially you have to think about your differential diagnosis, act quick to treat, keep the patient safe, stabilize the patient, and most importantly, have the patient family aware of those things so that for the next, they are ready to treat those things or help them altogether.
Okay. So it sounds like you really have to be quick on your feet to react to those unexpected reactions while also maintaining a line of communications with the family of the patient. Okay, so if you're in surgery, how do you determine the appropriate depth of anesthesia for any given patient?
When providing anesthesia, the most important thing is to make sure that the depth of anesthetic matches the stimulation level of the surgery needed. In the operating room, we are fortunately equipped with multiple data points that can point us to a safe plane of anesthesia. First thing that comes to mind would be the patient's behavior with stimulation. And that starts with your induction of anesthesia. After you induce anesthesia, the first stimulation that occurs is your intubation. Now, depending on how the patient tolerates the intubation, you know of your depth of anesthesia from the start of the procedure, even before the procedure starts. Now, as the procedure starts and moves along, you would depend on multiple values. First one would be your vitals, your heart rate, your blood pressure, your respiratory rate. Second, there are different monitors that you can use to measure the exact depth of anesthetic, one being your neuromuscular monitors to measure the depth of paralytics. Second would be a BIS monitor that would study the brain wave of a patient. You would want it to be between certain numbers to assure that the patient doesn't have any recollection or to assure the depth of anesthetic. And third, the one thing that would tell you exactly how much anesthesia that you're giving is the concentration of inhalation anesthetic or IV anesthesia. So if you're providing, once you're providing inhalation anesthetic, the machine and the machine would essentially tell you the amount, the concentration of inhalation anesthetic that you would be given. It would be measuring the amount of anesthesia that's in the patient's lung, and it would give you a value for the concentration of anesthesia that's in the alveoli in the patient's lung. That value is commonly known as a MAC. So if the patient reaches 1.0 MAC, this is an abbreviation for mean alveolar concentration. That essentially tells you that the patient is at a depth of anesthesia that they shouldn't typically respond to stimuli. If you go further into the literature, at 1 MAC, they tell you that 50% of the population shouldn't respond to stimuli. And ultimately, at 1.2 MAC level, 90-plus people would not respond to stimuli. You would also consider your hemodynamics when you give that level of anesthesia, as well as your patient age, patient comorbidities, body chemistry, and medications. So there's a lot of factors, data points. As usual in anesthesia, things are very dynamic, and you would have to adjust based on the patient, the individual patient.
Oh, yeah. We talked earlier about the BIS monitor and the train of force. I appreciate you elaborating further. What about these factors in other forms of anesthesia? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Now, the last, that answer assumes that you're doing general anesthesia, but for other surgeries that require regional anesthesia, spinal anesthesia, or just pure sedation techniques or approaches, your vitals and patient movement would tell you if the depth of anesthesia or if your regional on your actual block is actually working. For example, if there is a shoulder surgery and the anesthesiologist or the anesthesia team decides to do a nerve block and sedation, so you would typically do the nerve block prior to surgery. You would test out the nerve block with the patient's movement and sensation prior to inducing the sedation. And as the patient is sedated, the surgery starts and you see how the initial stimulation of that surgery affects the patient's movement, the patient's breathing patterns, or the patient's hemodynamics, heart rate, and blood pressure.
Thank you for elaborating. What advice do you have for medical students considering a career in anesthesiology?
As far as advice for a medical student, any medical student really, is to essentially do a self-analysis of who you are, what you're looking for, what stressors you can handle, and what you want to do with the field of medicine. For a med student considering anesthesiology, they would have to see if the personalities of anesthesia fits them well. Now, they might think or behave like a surgeon, and they would not like the field of anesthesia at all. So personality assessment is a big one. Second, you would want to see how well you do under pressure. Again, going back to your initial question, the misconception is that anesthesia is very laid back and it's an easy job, but it is easy until it's not. So you have to know how you do in those stressful situations if you can adapt quickly. And third, if you really know that anesthesiology is for you, you like doing things with your hands while being in the operating room, while not having a very long history with a patient, if you like the fast-paced and dynamic nature of anesthesia, is to shadow as much as possible, be exposed to the specialty as much as possible. Try to see how you can get into the OR to see how you're tolerated and if you actually like that field, or if you want to go over the curtain and join the surgical teammates, or if you don't want to do anything with the operating room at all. So personality is important. Second, how do you handle the doses of pressure that comes with the job? Three is being exposed. And lastly, another thing that's important is how do you do with the multitasking, managing personalities? Because anesthesia is not only about you. You have to manage, again, the patient, the surgical team, the nursing staff, the administration, and yourself. So there's a lot of multitasking and juggling going on. It's worth noting, in regards of pressure, the good thing about anesthesia, and I always sympathize with my surgical colleagues because of that, the pressure is intermittent. So you might have a high pressure case, a pleasant case, and that's it for the day. And then you go again the next day. You may have great cases only. You may have an easy day, or a difficult day, but it doesn't last for a long time. I do feel like, and this is me looking on the other side, that a surgical colleague is always under pressure to perform at all times, when they're in surgery, when they're a clinic, having to deal with the patients post-operatively, their complication that can happen, the infections that can happen. So I feel like depression, surgical specialty is always on, and that requires a different level of skill set, maybe a more advanced a level of management, for lack of better words. But in anesthesia, you have spurts of it, and it's gone, and then you can start again and have another stressful moment, maybe not a stressful moment, but that ultimately finishes and you go about your day. And when your day is done, in anesthesia, for the most part, is fully done. You don't have to worry about your patients in the hospital. Most of the time, your colleagues that are covering calls or taking over would gladly take a cover for you, and you don't have to worry about those things when you come home. So that's a good part too.
Thank you so much, Dr. Oliver, for agreeing to come on and answer our questions. It's really well appreciated. But this marks the end of our questions and the end of this first podcast. Today we covered what anesthesia actually is, how it works, what happens before you go under, behind the scenes, and wrapped it up with a Q&A. Hopefully this episode helped make something that feels pretty mysterious a little bit more understandable. But there's still so much to talk about. In the second episode, we'll explore the risks and complications of anesthesia, what can go wrong, and how anesthesia providers prepare to handle emergencies. We'll also look at the future of anesthesia, new technologies, new drugs, and where the field is heading. Thank you so much for tuning in. See you next time.